The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will dig more into the main theme of the March issue of Our State Magazine, Where We're From. There are 9 articles of varying lengths, so let's see how much we can squeeze into this month's episodes. The article we'll start with today is A Town Called Bath. A tiny community at the confluence of two waterways in Beaufort County is where it all began for North Carolina. Just north of the Pamlico River on Bath Creek sits our state's earliest town, founded in 1705. A block away on Craven Street, St. Thomas Episcopal Church has been holding services for 300 years. And on the lead page, there's an aerial photo, probably from a drone, looking down over Bath Creek and over the verdant landscape. On the page, we see a picture, very, very plain, a picture of St. Thomas Episcopal Church. No steeple that we can see, very plain doorway with double doors. Old, you can tell the brick is very old, but very simple structure. The bells of Bath ring at noon. They're sounding out as general across the broad peninsula where lies the oldest North Carolina town. Once these chimes are done, only the occasional screeching of gulls and squawking of great blue herons break the silence lying over the old port. The town sits 10 feet above the water, and a rise near the foot of King Street holds many a soul buried in the former churchyard of the Bath AME Zion Church, now honored by a large marble slab. A buoyancy, a lightness is in the air here, perhaps because the original village is a village still, just a scant square mile in Bath's easily walkable historic area, not far from its Native American precursor, Secotan. Large pines and towering pecan trees leave an open understory where clapboard houses and a few churches are set comfortably far apart. Most of the way from Bath Creek to Back Creek, one can see plumb through these grounds. A walker on Bath's streets in remembrance of past times may well see right into those old times, too. At the waterside corner of Main and Front Streets, Bonner's Point, there's a clear view, after the fog and mist of a morning lift, of the Pamlico River from which hundreds of ships once came into Bath and went back out. One would be standing now exactly where Bath Town co-founder John Lawson lived after surveying and laying out 71 lots in 1705. He chose lots 5 and 6 for himself, his common-law wife, Hannah Smith, and their future daughter, Isabella. A rather fine view for the 30-year-old explorer, surveyor, and his family, a riverine vantage for him to sit and envision his writing of one of the earliest and most important pieces of natural world reportage in North Carolina's literary history, A New Voyage to Carolina. So let the bells ring out and carol out. Let the long dead speak. As the earliest North Carolina town, Bath holds several other firsts. The first church, St. Thomas Episcopal Church, an Anglican parish, established shortly after Bath County was founded in 1696, though a church building was not erected until nearly 30 years later. The first library. More than 150 books were sent from England by clergyman Thomas Bray before there was anywhere in Bath to house them. Soon scattered, only one volume remains, and it is now in the possession of the Diocese of East Carolina. The first official port of entry. Bath's customs and regulatory area covered an enormous area by British maritime decree, everything north and east of Cape Fear. The first shipyard. Deputy Governor Thomas Carey ordered a 46-foot sloop from shipbuilder Thomas Harding in 1710. Bath's first decade alone comprised an astonishing and challenging set of early times for the new town: a civil war in the colony called Carey's Rebellion, a rival between Governor Edward Hyde and Deputy Governor Carey, and between Anglicans and Quakers, an attack of an arbovirus called yellow fever that would fell the unfortunate Governor Hyde, and the September 1711 tax across the Neuse and Pamlico area by the Tuscarora Indians and their allies. The Indians were so furious at John Lawson and Baron von Graftenried's 1710 importation of Swiss and Palatine refugees from England to the state's second European colonial town, Newbern, the Tuscaroran town, Chautauqua, that they captured and tortured Lawson, made him the first victim of their war, and swelled Bath's population with widows and orphans. 5 years after the Tuscarora's defeat in 1713 came the pirate Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard. After blockading Charleston, he showed up in Bath, secured the king's pardon for pirates, took a teenage wife, and set up a riotous residence on Plum Point. When the buccaneers sailed again for the high seas, salvaging, so he said, deserted vessels that he found and bringing plunder back to Bath, its merchant shippers sought relief. The British Royal Navy's Lieutenant Robert Maynard sailed two sloops down from Virginia and battled Blackbeard off Springer's Point on Ocracoke, killing and beheading him on November 22, 1718. Then Maynard cruised across Pamlico Sound, showing the people of Bath his bowsprit's decor, Blackbeard's bloody head. As if devilish pirates were not enough, there also seems to have been a long-running problem with preachers in the port of Bath. This was due, perhaps, to too many early years without the benefit of clergy, or perhaps from the nature of the clergy who did, from time to time, show up. The malcontent Reverend John Ermston of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel laid this dismal observation upon the new village of Bath on September 22, 1714. 3 years after the start of the Tuscarora War. "We expect to hear that famous city of Bath, consisting of 9 houses, or rather cottages, once styled the metropolis and seat of government, will be totally deserted." Yet that did not happen. Instead, in 1734, the lovely Flemish bonded brick St. Thomas Church took shape. As the Reverend John Garcia was signing on as Bath's Anglican spiritual leader. Garcia, presumed Spanish, spoke poor English and was hardly well paid. He finally sued the church for his year's overdue salary. The miserable minister lamented the sin in the Bath parish, writing that adultery, incest, blasphemy, and all kinds of profaneness has got such a deep root. At last he was set free from it all, falling from his horse to his death in 1744. By the late 1730s, bombastic Great Awakening evangelist George Whitfield, his verse purported to have a mile-long range, had stopped in Bath for the first of several visits, going about soul-saving in what he called the ungospelized wilds of North Carolina. Legend has it that Whitfield became so enraged by Bath antagonists wanting him out of their freewheeling town that he left after standing on his wagon, waving his shoe and shouting like a conjurer before God and everybody. "If a place won't listen to the word, you shake the dust off your feet, and the town shall be cursed. I have put a curse on this town for 100 years. So who were these folks who cast themselves in the Carolina wilderness to seek their fortunes in this early settlement? Some were thrown there by others, no fortune intended for them, like the enslaved woman Dido, already at work in earliest Bath by the time John Lawson showed up. Some were first generation, new to the new world, well off, ambitious young men with ties to family back in the old country. Of these leading folks, the privileged, a few illustrate the pattern. Lawson, son of a well-connected London doctor with family in Yorkshire ached from early on to excel in a science, possibly hoping to get into England's Royal Society. Urged to explore the Carolinas and offered a free sail to Charleston, off he went. Connecting with London apothecary James Petivere to do a new world plant collecting for him, Lawson's path was set. Christopher Gale, eldest of four brothers from a wealthy Yorkshire family, arrived in Carolina about 1700. He married Sarah Harvey, widow of the late Governor Thomas Harvey, and moved quickly to the top. Gale set himself up in coastwise trade north to New England and Indian trade west to the Cherokee Nation, living at Kirby Grange just outside of Bath and serving for years as North Carolina's colonial chief justice, often in conflict with whoever was the current colonial governor. Charles Eden, of County Durham, England, became governor in 1714, receiving 1,000 acres from the Lord's proprietors to sweeten his deal. Eden's home, called Thistleworth, lay among the west banks of Bath Creek, though implications of collusion with neighbor Blackbeard may have driven him in 1719 to his Eden House plantation in Bartee County, where at the Chowan River's mouth, he died in 1722. Captain Michael Coutanche, a French mariner and merchant from the Isle of Jersey, sailed in about 1739 from Boston to Bath, where a few years hence he built at the corner of Carteret and Main Streets a large wooden double-chimney domicile and mercantile building. Of a later owner of the place, Robert Palmer, the 1760s Royal Governor William Tryon, he's the namesake of the palace in Newbern, wrote, "He had a very excellent house and plantation at Bath, which I often resided in with my family, being hospitably entertained by him." Bath's hospitality was hardly restricted to private homes, nor offered only by men. Of three sailors' shebangs opened in 1756, one of the tavern keepers was a woman named Morning Blenn. And of the two in 1761, the top keg tapper and drinks dispenser of one of them was likewise a woman, one Mary Smith. These folks were just a few residents of the busy port of Bath. Clearly, those who arrived with capital and advantage from back in the old world were free to improve their lots here in the new one. They gathered up lands, positions, and trade in no small part through the displacement of indigenous communities and the unrewarded efforts of their laboring bondsmen. If there were an 18th century heyday in Bath, it was fairly short-lived, for North Carolina's maritime trade, the concept of which the town had helped prove out, would be moving on upriver to Washington and shared by other interior coastal ports of entry, Beaufort, Brunswick, Currituck, Roanoke, even before the American Revolution. But none of this takes anything away from Bath, a modest river port with its small ships, its wharves, inns, taverns, riverine manufactories, nor from Bath's early folk, who showed a scattered backcountry people how to engage with the watery world. Out on Ocracoke last fall, Hyde County historian and marine life naturalist Gene Balance remarked that folks were nowadays catching speckled trout up Bath Creek. "Those trout like a little salt," he said. "The presence of new fish in the waters of Old Bath is a harbinger of change. Salt as a bringer of trout, no less, a causer of coastal ghost forests, too, in the advancing 21st century. Yet we can still sense some of the old world of three centuries past here, that of ships and shipping, of our need only to stroll slowly down Bath's old lanes below Carteret Street, past St. Thomas Churchyard, and on to Bonner's Point. And imagine here, through the mists of time, those 71 lots being laid out by Lawson, the 30-year-old who first wrote of and spoke to us about the Carolina territories to the west. He's suddenly there before us in the spectral air, a young man too busy at his task of lining out the small peninsula to stop and talk, too engaged in squaring up all the pieces of this very first place in our colonial province, just big and brave enough to call itself a town. Now I'll go through the pictures that are part of this article. Robert Palmer, who was elected to the General Assembly from Bath in 1762, conducted business in his office at what's now known as the Palmer Marsh House. Built in 1751 by French mariner and merchant Michael Coutanche, it's one of the oldest houses in North Carolina. And in that we see a fireplace with a looks like the room is white-walled with trims in sort of a crimson red. Everything that I see is crimson. And there's an older table, well-defined table, with implements on it, such as brass candlesticks, a plume, an inkwell, some old books, and several other pieces there. The doorways are rather short, as the people were shorter then. And there's a large fireplace, which would certainly have drawn and created a lot of heat in the room. And there's a brass piece in front of it that would keep the logs from rolling out into the room. And looks like a tile surround for the fireplace as well. And a portrait above the fireplace mantle. Going backward here, after a day of sailing on the Pamlico River and Sound, boaters docked their crafts at the Bath Harbor Marina on the eastern shore of Bath Creek. And there we can see a bridge. I don't know if that's a pedestrian bridge or a motorway bridge. And beneath that, a number of sailing sloops docked there. A little mini article here says Bath Today. On a recent Halloweentide morning, a small pirate ship sat in a yard on Bath's Craven Street, pointed east with three skeletons at halyards and helm. A block away, Blackbeard's ghost, as it were, was operating a drinking and dining establishment at the corner of Carteret and Main, near the bridge over Bath Creek. Blackbeard's Tavern. In the old Bath High School at the corner of Carteret and King Streets, resides the historic Bath Exhibit Center, which leads visitors through many stages of this locale's natural and human heritage, from its Native American origins to the current moment. Most days, a wonder world of ropes, kegs, barrels, potsherds, and photographs tells the small town's involved and impressive maritime tale. A block away from the exhibit center is the Palmer Marsh House, a big two-story wooden home and mercantile building built by Captain Michael Coutanche around 1751, making it one of the oldest houses standing in our state. Coutanche, whose name lives on as a major Greenville thoroughfare, Coutanche Street, now lies in the small graveyard beneath overarching pecan trees on the home's grand east side yard. As far more than a mere nod to its point of entry past, the North Carolina State Dock at the Bath Creek Bridge is a tying-up facility for modern mariners that's free for up to 72 hours. The long dock, an easy walk from the village, offers no amenities beyond cleats, and thus is perhaps much like what ship captains in the early 1700s found awaiting them. And we have a side view of the house that I was just telling you about, where the interior, the Palmer Marsh House, built by Captain Coutanche. And I was saying that it's red, it's sort of crimson trim inside the house, and the house itself is a reddish color, sort of reddish crimson color on the outside. The boards are painted, and then a sort of a reddish orange brick for the very large brick fireplaces. There's also a photo of the shipbuilding exhibit in the, what I guess was the old Bath High School, the historic Bath Exhibit Center. And then there's a picture of the old high school. Travel back to the 1700s at the historic Bath Exhibit Center, where you'll find displays on early shipbuilding and, of course, Blackbeard, the town's most notorious former resident. And there's a picture of Blackbeard with his tendrils of his beard with smoke coming away from them. And standing, looking very, a little bit dapper as a pirate, I suppose. And then the old high school building that's now the exhibit hall. There's a Bonner House sits on land that John Lawson once owned. Across the street at Bonner's Point, visitors can take in breathtaking views of Bath Creek as it makes its way to the Pamlico River. Half a mile north on Carteret Street is the former site of the Bath AME Zion Church. And we see the cornerstone here for the churchyard, marking the churchyard. The Bonner House is surrounded by a picket fence with crepe myrtle trees in the yard and looks like great oak trees in the yard, pin oaks. And it is a two-story house. There's a well in front that it has a similar cedar shake roof as the house does, and a yellow front door. And it's a two-story house. Actually, it's probably a three-story house in different sections. There's also a picture of John Lawson with, I don't know if this is a wig or his normal hair, but it's parted down the middle and really curly hair from that era, early 1700s era. And a picture of the book that he wrote, A New Voyage to Carolina, containing the excellent descriptions and natural library of that country. It's in a journal and so forth. And then a picture of the Bath Creek looking out over at Bonner's Point. All right. Okay, I'm going to skip to the North Carolina icon section, and this is about the Appalachian Trail. In the late 19th century, a young Rufus Morgan frequently set off into Nantahala Forest to explore the woods in his backyard, following game trails and Cherokee hunting paths. Eventually, he left North Carolina to attend seminary and became an Episcopal priest. When he moved back to Macon County in 1940, he discovered that quite a bit had changed. Just 3 years before the Reverend's return, volunteers in the Civil Conservation Corps had completed the Appalachian Trail, which stretches from Georgia to Maine, the longest hiking-only path in the world. But it wasn't the Appalachian Trail. The Appalachian Trail wasn't a new trail. It connected existing paths, including the Native American hunting trails that Morgan has hiked as a child. Armed with a crosscut saw and a scythe, he would walk along the Appalachian Trail, often alone, clearing fallen trees and cutting back brush, keeping the path easy to follow. His work became the foundation for the Nantahala Hiking Club, one of 30 volunteer groups that maintain the Appalachian Trail year-round. If you came to hike with Rufus Morgan, he'd probably give you a tool, says Victor Troutel, the club's current president. You were going to work with him while you were hiking with him. As a respected minister, Morgan inspired many people to join him. They would sit for devotionals and listen to him preach along the path. The club grew as more people became fascinated with the colossal trail. Today, about 350 members head out on excursions every Wednesday to maintain the 60 miles of trail for which the club is responsible. Morgan remained involved until he died in 1983 at age 98. He'd lost his sight and hearing, but he still hiked regularly. His mission to maintain the Appalachian Trail remains at the heart of the Nantahala Hiking Club. If you want to get close to God, Truntel says, there's nothing better than to hike to the top of a mountain and look out on his creation. Flipping back to the front page of this article, there's a beautiful picture of the Appalachian Trail. You see the stony and dirt path leading, or going, looks like it's going downhill. As Appalachian hikers traverse far western parts of North Carolina, including the Roan Highlands, Rufus Morgan helped maintain parts of the trail until his death in 1983. And there's a picture of Rufus in his older days on the corner there. And it looks like the picture that we see of the Appalachian Trail is in... there's oleander, or not oleander, rhododendron, and other lush greens. And the sky is either at sunset or sunrise. It's a beautiful pink-yellow glow to the sky at that point. There's a another here, Clingman's Dome. After completing 200 miles on foot, Appalachian Trail through hikers who began their trek at Springer Mountain in Georgia reached the tallest peak along the trail, Clingman's Dome. At 6,643 feet, the towering landmark is also the highest point in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the third tallest mountain east of the Mississippi. In order to take advantage of prime weather conditions, thru-hikers travel from Georgia to Maine within the standard five-month window, begin their hike in March. Once they reach Clingman's Dome, they are rewarded with views that stretch as far as 100 miles. An observation deck at Clingman's Dome, located about a half mile from the Appalachian Trail, gives visitors a 360-degree view of the landscape. And it is an interesting observation deck. It's raised up from the mountain floor, and it is a 360-degree view. It's a circle that you could walk around the whole thing, and then it has a leading path away from it. And again, the view is either at sunrise or sunset. It's hard to tell. But beautiful yellows and pinks and in the sky. It's really quite pretty with you see fir trees in the below that. Tar Heel Trailblazer. North Carolina is home to more than 300 miles of the Appalachian Trail, the highest peak along the path, and the woman who hiked the whole thing in record time, 46 days, 11 hours, and 20 minutes. In 2011, Hendersonville-born Jennifer Farr Davis began her third thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail. Hiking south from Maine, she traversed 47 miles each day. By that point in her hiking career, she had traveled all over the world, hiking Mount Kilimanjaro, Machu Picchu, and Mont Blanc, but the Appalachian Trail always called her home. Davis is now an award-winning author and speaker living in Asheville. Through the Blue Ridge Hiking Company she founded, she shares the beauty of the Appalachian Trail and the many other spectacular paths that North Carolina has to offer. To learn more about Blue Ridge Hiking Company, visit BlueRidgeHikingCo.com. And to watch Jennifer Farr, or to listen to her in action and hear about her hikes, you can go to OurState.com/app-trail to learn more about her career as a hiker. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you'd enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.